Want to make your beer money go further? Want to make homebrew that's even more delicious? Download Brew Guru, the free smartphone app made by our friends at the American Homebrewers Association. Brew Guru helps beer lovers like you save money on beer and beer brewing supplies, and it serves up exclusive content from Zymergy Magazine and homebrewersassociation.org. Brew Guru is free for Android, iPhone, and iPad. Check it out. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, September 29th, 2016. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Stan Hieronymus joins us to talk about his latest book, Brewing Local, American-Grown Beer. Brewers across the country are using locally sourced ingredients to put their own stamp on our favorite beverage. If you're new to home brewing or would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And if you buy any of our DVD combos, you get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener. And don't forget to get a copy of our Brewer's Logbook. You can use it to log and track up to 50 batches of beer. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. We also have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon shopping, think of us first and click on our associate link on basicbrewing.com. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show, and we greatly appreciate your support there. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site as well. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes, our Android app on Amazon.com. We have a Windows Phone app. We're on the BlackBerry Podcast Directory. We're on the Stitcher app. We're on Google Play Music. And we're on the iHeartRadio app now, too. And if you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our virtual guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support. And thanks to everybody who's done so already. This past Saturday, I spent the afternoon at the Home Brewery in Fayetteville, the last time before it changes hands from Andy Sparks to Steve Wilkes. It'll change hands and change names as well. It'll become Steve's Brew Shop. And I know it's bittersweet for Andy handing over the keys after more than two decades, but I know that he'll have a great time with his wood-fired pizza business. And I know that Steve is excited to get Steve's Brew Shop going. Ben Miller from Fossil Cove brought a keg of his Simcoe IPA to the shop, which was delicious and really cool of Ben to do that. A bunch of people showed up to wish Andy well. And I also went down into my basement and brought up my last bottle of Caged and Corked La Folie from New Belgium. That's back when they hand-bottled and hand-numbered those things. This one was from 2008. And still very, very tasty. I hear it's on tap here in town at West Mountain. And I also hear that Casey from Siloam Springs, Casey Letillier, I heard a rumor that he's brewing over at West Mountain now. So we need to get together with him and see what he's up to. We have a new sponsor this week, Micro Hops, makers of Hop Shine, premium hop essence. Hopshine is a product that is produced with a proprietary extraction process that concentrates the essence of fresh Pacific Northwest hops into a liquid that you can put right into your beer, or any beverage for that matter, at serving time. Right now, there are three flavors of Hopshine available: Mega Blend, Spicy Piney, and Fruity Floral. And I've been playing with the Hopshine here at the house, and it's kind of like instant dry or wet hopping right in the glass or before bottling or kegging. It's got an eyedropper. It's a little one-ounce bottle. It's got an eyedropper. And if you want to boost the flavor of a hoppy pale ale, or if you're in a situation where the beer isn't the best, you can make it better with just a squirt of this stuff. It's really good. I picked up a six-pack of IPA the other day, one of my favorite brands of IPA, but apparently it was on the shelf too long at the liquor store, and the hops had faded, but a squirt of Hopshine perked it right back up. So there are about 50 servings in each one-ounce bottle, and each serving is only about 36 cents each. Of course, you can use more or less than the suggested serving size if you like. So check out Hopshine for yourself. The website is hop-shine.com. And you can also find Hopshine on Amazon.com. Just search for Hopshine on Amazon. I got an email with some good news from Gary Glass, director of the Homebrewers Association. Gary says the American Homebrewers Association is excited to share the news that the California legislature has passed and Governor Jerry Brown has signed into law AB 2172. The new law will go into effect January 1st, 2017. Gary says this law will permit homebrew clubs and homebrewers to meet, discuss, and share their beer amongst themselves at licensed establishments across California. Gary says thank you to everybody who communicated with legislators and the governor's office to get this bill passed. Particular thanks go to the California Homebrewers Association that worked with Santee Assemblyman Brian Jones to get this bill through the California legislature. Well, that's good news. I appreciate the efforts of Gary Glass and the AHA for helping to promote positive homebrewing legislation across the country and really keep it on top of things. Also in the mailbag, Chris from Youngstown, Ohio, over at Bascule Brewing Company writes, "I really miss emails with Steve. I'm sure you have a ton of content to get to, and Steve has his new venture, but I could listen to you and Steve sifting through emails for hours and never get tired of it." That makes one of you. No. any chance of getting the two of you together for a good old-fashioned email read-through? Well, that's a fun idea. It's been a while since we did an email reading show. If you like that idea, email us some brewing questions. And we can sit down and sip a beer while fielding those. You can find me on james@basicbrewing.com or the contact form at basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. The weather is changing, so with the change in the seasons, it's time to check out the seasonal kit offerings from our sponsors Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. How about Ichabod Pumpkin Ale? I know, there are pumpkin beer skeptics and critics out there. People roll their eyes when they think about pumpkin beer. But if you like pumpkin beer, brew one. The website says, "This spiced beer is inspired by Tulsa Brewing Company's Old Pumpkinhead. The brew pub is no longer in business, but the recipe is a frequent request from Tulsa customers that want to recreate one of their favorite holiday beers. Old Pumpkinhead was their most popular seasonal offering. It was traditionally brewed in late September, early October, and was available on draft through Thanksgiving weekend or until the tap ran dry. High Gravity's extract kits use only the highest quality ingredients and are assembled when you order, so they contain the freshest possible ingredients. High Gravity's pumpkin spices are from Penzies Spices, renowned for their high-quality ingredients." I bet that's tasty. Ichabod Ale, Ichabod Pumpkin Ale from the High Gravity site. Desiree and Dave know their stuff. Check out all their ingredient kits and their line of electric brewing systems at highgravitybrew.com. Okay, let's talk to Stan Hieronymus about brewing local. Stan Hieronymus, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, I should say, I usually say welcome back to the people who have been on the show several times, and you certainly have, and it's always fun when you do. You've written now, is this your fourth book?
Fourth for Brewers Publications.
Brewing Local, American-Grown Beer. And as usual, it's a good read and full of useful information. But the title... I have to say that I'm a curmudgeon and a skeptical guy, and whenever the word "local" in quotation marks is used with food or beer, I get my antennae raise, you know, because it's a word that's been used in several different ways. How do you use it? How do you define brewing local?
I'll back up real quick and we'll just wander way off track to begin with. So a couple of years ago, it was actually more than 2 years ago, the idea for a book, I think, came out of sort of a discussion at the Brewers Association, and Christy Switzer, who's the publisher of Brewers Publications, suggested to me I'd be interested in writing this book, which probably would have been called Indigenous Beer. And at the time, there was a category in at GABF, Indigenous Beer. And the idea was to use, they could be historical beers like Sati, but also, you know, the growing interest in incorporating local ingredients. And it took us a long time, with me several times saying, I just can't put my head around this, what the book would be about. Chrissy and I finally figured it out. And then I said I would write the book on the last day of judging for GABF 2014. And a couple hours later, I was talking to Randy Mosher, and Randy had judged the finals of the Indigenous Beer category. And I said, oh, that's funny, because I think I'm going to do this book. And he said, well, I'm not sure you want to do that, because we just suggested they eliminate the category. To which I said, that's fine, because I think it confuses things. Because what we decided to do is discard all history outside, everything outside the United States, basically. Because there's a whole world of things out there. When you go to Brazil, you see all these different fruits that people are using. And, you know, it would be an encyclopedia of ingredients just to say what people can use in the world and maybe using in the future and stuff like that. And that's why we decided to narrow it down in the United States, but keep that first part of the idea, which was to look at, you know, what beers did evolve in U.S. history before we got down to one style, which was the pale adjunct lager. And then what people are doing now, which is the exciting part. And the other reason, like a couple of weeks before GABF, I was at Scratch Brewing in Southern Illinois. And as they're, at least in my small world, famous for using foraged ingredients. And I was talking to Aaron Kleidine, one of the founders there, about burdock root. And he was... They have a pizza oven, a wood-fired pizza oven there that they make bread into. So he can put that burdock root in there and toast that root to different levels of toast, just like maltsters do, and get all these, you know, toast it lightly and get something to use like Munich malt, toast it darker, and now you've got a black patten. And, you know, that starts to get intriguing. So how people can use the ingredients near them to add local character to the beer. And one of the, that's what I would call a local beer, is when it has flavors of the region. Not all the ingredients need to be grown in the region.
That was my next question, is say you've got a 3-barrel brewery down the street from your house, but they brew with you know, German malts and, you know, New Zealand hops, is it still a local beer?
To me, it is, because people buy local, quote, local coffee all the time because it's roasted locally, but those beans are not grown locally. And we don't have these, maybe, that, I shouldn't say that. I'm sure within the coffee world, they do have these debates about how much of it is needed to have it be local. But I think when you take all the parts and where you assemble it, that is a gigantic step towards going local. But you can use these other ingredients, whether it's stuff from the yard, occasionally locally grown hops, in some areas where you're going to be able to get malted grain that was grown nearby.
Yeah, you spend and I thought the book, you know, when I read the title or when I read the description, I thought it was going to be about foraging, about using things, you know, within the property. And there is some of that. There is, and we've featured Scratch Brewing here on the show. Mm-hmm. But it's more about that. It's more about a history of American beers and how they evolved with, you know, the local ingredients. And it's about terroir, which is a wine term. But you and then Sam Calagione in the introduction talk about terroir and talk about the Rheinheitsgebot in in less than flattering terms. So what is your definition of terroir and how can it apply to beer and brewing?
Well, realistically, I think terroir applies to all food products. And depending upon you how you read those definitions in France to begin with, and certainly the way people in France take it, and it is most extreme level, they think of it as understanding the food around you based upon the geography around you. That's really hard to do when you're tasting blind, although obviously those sommeliers who have I think it's Masters of Wine or something, they have MW before your name, and they can taste this wine and say it's from some particular vineyard in Chile. So there is some of that they can taste that's unique to the place, but in fact, all plants, it's not just how much sunlight they get. It's not just where they grow or that much rain, but it's the actual location. And so science can explain the role of this what's called methylated DNA, and methylated DNA is being examined much more in terms of humans these days, because if you can get that shift, then that turns genes on and off. So in theory, within a family, you can get cancer-causing genes turned off that have always been a problem through generations. That's like way beyond my pay grade. But that same thing is true, and that's where I first learned about that was in terms of the hop growers. And the easiest examples for me come in terms of hops. As hop breeding began in the early 20th century, they did not do this in the Czech Republic. The hop breeder there was worried about those hops changing. So what you see is a series of Oswald clones. Oswald's the breeder. And he's constantly selecting hops. And so you're making sure you keep that purity. So they taste the same. You know, you get the same alpha, beta. They don't have a lot of examination of oils then. But where you know that the plant is, when you measure, it's the same. But also when you taste it in beer, it's the same. More recently, in the Tettnang region, so the Tettnanger hops, the Spalter hops, and Saaz hops, as well as Lupland in Poland, are so genetically similar that you can't really tell the difference. You know, you could argue that they did not begin in Tettnang. We know that. They could have started out in Spalt and go to Saaz, could have said, which is actually Jatek, or they could have started out in the Czech Republic and ended up in Spalt. In either case, it's more than 500 years ago. So you've got these genetically very similar hops. Well, they're examining the plants in Tettnang to see how similar they are to those other two, and additionally how similar they are to each other in the Tettnang region, because hops are constantly going to be changing in a field unless you're really vigilant, because seeds drop, another plant comes up and grows. You do not want that happening. You need to take it off of rhizomes because they don't grow true to type in seeds. And in examining that in Tettnang, they found it an incredible similarity to begin with, in part because their plants are older. Usually hops will check out after about 25 years. And theirs have been there longer, and they were able to keep this sort of purity going and things like that. But what they also found when they started doing these comparisons, that one of the Oswald clones was actually a Fuggle hop. Hmm. And, you know, and Fuggle, it's another Landrace hop. Growing in the same environment as the Czech Saaz hops, it took on the same character as the Czech Saaz hops. So that's an example of terroir, how the landscape around in this case, the plant, modifies it.
Well, in a similar fashion, you know, you can take the same rhizome, cut it in half, and you know, send one part to one part of the world and another part to the other part of the world, and you get different tasting or different performing hops. If you take the same ingredients, the same recipe, and you brew it in different breweries in different parts of the country or different parts in the world, you can get maybe a different product from that. And is that a part of terroir as well?
I think so. And it's certainly the environment of the brewery. It's the shape of your brewing vessels. You see that, for instance, it'll be in the November All About Beer magazine, but it's online right now. They asked me to look at what places like Sierra Nevada and New Belgium Brewing are doing in order to, you know, because they're brewing in North Carolina, having been brewing in California and in Colorado. And so Sierra Nevada, and I should know these right off the top of my head, but obviously North Carolina is a much higher altitude than Chico. So that changes, you know, now you're boiling at a lower temperature, changes your hop utilization, changes your maillard creation. You know, these are all changes simply because of a change in altitude. You know, we talk about the water and things like that, which is important, but you can modify your water to make it exactly like one place or the other. It's really hard to modify the altitude to say, oh, I'm going to build this particular brewery 2,000 feet in the air.
One big chapter, you talk about corn. You call it King Corn. And corn has a bad reputation among, you know, beer lovers or people who call themselves good beer lovers and home brewers, because it's an adjunct, you know, that the big brewers use to, you know, sort of dumb down their beers. Does corn have is corn's reputation well deserved, or is it sort of one of these myths or you know, things that we spread that aren't true?
Overall, I would say it's a myth. Obviously, it was complicit in the dumbing down of beer in the United States, whether it's corn or rice, if you look back, potatoes worked very well, and that goes to an interesting point when you're talking about terroir, or at least the differences in the ingredients you're used. There, no matter what when you get heirloom potatoes, you don't get a whole lot of difference in flavors. When you get heirloom corn, you can definitely see differences in the flavor. Obviously, at an industrial level, the only interest in corn is it's a cheap fermentable. It lightens up the beer. They're not looking for corn flavor. As a quick aside, and this is actually not a good example because it's cheating, but it does drive me crazy when hardcore homebrewers will taste Budweiser and complain about the corn flavor since it's made with rice. you can get a sweet beer, but that's not, you know, that's an overall decision that the brewery's making. So if you look historically, people were trying to brew with corn before in the late 1500s in the United States, briefly, because it was here. And at the time, there's a little bit of barley that is indigenous to the United States, but not very much. You know, we got our barley from Europe. For the most part, the two row from Europe, and it grew okay on the coast. As soon as it moved inland, it started to struggle. But there was also six row from Spain. And that six row grew much better, and it still is easier to grow in many regions. particularly as you move into upstate New York, the first barley growing there, and then further into the Midwest. And now, thanks in part to climate change, the need to keep moving farther north into Canada, that six row was easier to grow. The problem is, of course, six row had more protein. It did not taste as good, but it was something the brewers could get. So those efforts to brew with corn, even though they continued into the 19th century, it was a realization that you could take corn, rice, or potatoes. As an adjunct, they would cut out what I would actually call a husky flavor that you're getting with the six row, and that ugly flavor. It also made for a clearer beer. And at that time, of course, people were starting to use glasses. So it was a better looking beer. Importantly enough, a more stable beer, but it tasted more like Bohemian Pilsner, which people were beginning to get a taste of. And that was a much lighter on the palate beer than the German lager beers that were so prominent in the 1850s and 1860s. Their growth was limited because of ingredients. So you had two things going on. It was more useful ingredients, more abundant ingredients, and they were producing a product that people were interested in. It was a product with more flavor than, I'm not sure who to pick on, but we'll say than Coors Light or Miller Lite. And it still was a hoppy beer with more malted flavor as well. Then over time, that's when it gets dialed down. Corn made that possible, but it wasn't. It was the marketers and bean counters, as I like to say.
Yeah, one of the things that I had always heard about six row was that it had a higher diastatic power, and you needed to use it when you wanted to use adjuncts. But it seems like to me that then, and this was kind of a revelation from your book, was that corn, it wasn't six row coming to the rescue of corn, so to speak. It was corn coming to the rescue of six row and creating a more balanced and better beer.
Right. Because people were inclined to use barley. In a way, I mean, the six row did sort of come to the rescue of corn, although corn doesn't really need beer. Yeah. When you think about it, we're finding plenty of uses for corn. last 4 weeks, we've been driving one direction or the other, and you know, it's been sort of fun to watch, and of course, in the middle of soybeans and corn, and to see the crop start to mature and think in about another 6 weeks, 2 months, how much different the landscape's going to look.
Mm. When it's no longer as high as an elephant's eye.
Exactly.
So where are we now? I mean, the book is kind of divided into sections. There's kind of a history section, and there's kind of what's happening now. And then there is, what would you call it, kind of a glossary of plants and local ingredients that you can find to use. And then there's recipes in the back, which people certainly should be drawn towards. You tell the story of brewing local through talking about breweries in the past and in the present who are using, you know, sort of indigenous ingredients or American grown ingredients to brew their beer. And they're not, you know, they're not all off the wall, you know, brewing with bark and things like that. But there's, you know, there are sort of more traditional stories to be told as well. But tell some of the stories of some of these breweries that you think sort of paint the picture of what you were trying to tell in this book.
Well, I think there's a lot of like Full Steam in North Carolina, which is very food oriented, and trying to promote a Southern food brewing culture, but also not interested in gimmicks at all. So you know, when their sweet potato beer, that's a potential crop that if they can use that. But one thing I talk to brewers about a lot is many of these beers do not scale up. You know, it's really hard to get enough pawpaws. very few people are growing them. The best, and you know, foraging for them, what they'll do is they'll put out a call as pawpaw season is coming across, saying to foragers, we'll pay $2 a pound or whatever. But whether it's persimmons or pawpaws, these aren't necessarily going to be a gigantic percentage of any brewery's production. It depends how big the brewery wants to be, obviously, whether you're making 1,000 barrels or you're making 100,000 barrels. But I think, just real quickly, at that commercial level, when you go to one of these beers made by walking events, and a quick bit of background. So that started in Colorado Springs in 2011. Eric Steen started it, and it was actually for homebrewers. You will go out with people familiar with the flora of the region and learn something about it. You didn't have to pick stuff and use it even necessarily. The idea is just to be inspired by being in that place. And Eric comes from the art world and place-based art. That's grown to where people will grab those ingredients, and commercial brewers were doing it. But generally, we're talking about a 7-barrel batch or maybe a 15-barrel batch. It's not a lot of beer. But then they do the events, and when you see the people hear the story about the beer, you realize that the connection the brewer is making to what he does, as a consumer, you just really appreciate that. It's not a factory situation, and it makes you realize that the other beer they're making, they have that same connection to. So I think that's part of it, of continuing to make beer made by your neighbors. That's a part of it at the commercial level. At the home brewing level, it just adds this whole other area of fun. You know, we've got hundreds of ingredients in the book, and that they're really only the beginning. You know, there are 150 kinds of sweet basil. There are 900 kinds of sage. Now, I'm not saying they're all different, but there are significant differences in basil. That's obviously true. Some people are in love with Thai basil, for instance. I just recently used it's called cinnamon basil, but it doesn't smell of cinnamon or anything like that, but it just adds this little different sort of herbal note. And also, if you do experiment with it, I can tell you that you're better off going light, because otherwise your friends will say, ah, pizza beer.
Yeah, I had a peach basil beer years ago that I didn't enjoy, but it was more of a wine cooler than a beer. Mm. But after reading, your book, or as I was reading it, I went out to my little garden that we have by the patio, and we have, you know, regular, I don't know what variety it is, but, you know, the basil that I make pesto with, and mm-hmm. then we also have Thai basil, and I tasted some of the leaves of those. And you were talking about, I believe you were talking about using basil as a bittering ingredient.
You can do that.
And I could see that. I mean, I tasted some leaves of that regular, you know, sort of, I don't know whether it's Italian, but I don't know from basil. But you know, tasting those leaves, it was bitter. And I could see where if you boiled that for a certain amount of time, you could get some bittering out of that. And then I tasted the Thai basil, and I came away with more of a licorice flavor. So I think I was thinking of, and unfortunately it's too late, my basil's gone to seed, but that would be a fun, like darker beer, taking the regular basil for bittering and then adding some of the Thai basil at the end to add sort of an anise kind of licorice-y component to it. And something like that is, you know, it makes it less intimidating. If it's something that you have right there at your house, Especially if you could try like some, you know, 1 gallon batches or something like that to try these out. You know, that's kind of a no brainer, and seems like a fun thing to do.
Yeah, you can even take that 1 gallon batch and split it into growlers, and dry herb your beer. Now I'm hyper enough in terms of if you're not boiling it, I certainly want to put it in a neutral spirit to make sure that I'm not contaminating the beer. So that's what I've done with a few things is mess around with different basils and stuff like that. And, you know, if we wanted to wait 2 more years for this book, and there's no guarantee we'll be able to get it done in 2 years, but as more universities are getting involved with brewer education, and some of them get enough funding that they've got some nice GC equipment and stuff like that, it'll be really fun if I can snooker some of them into looking at, because there are many of the same oils same compounds in things like lavender and basil and sage that are in hops. So, you know, what other fruity character are we going to be able to get when it has an interaction with a different yeast? So eventually we will be able to have both a West Coast basil beer and a Northeast basil beer. The Northeast basil beer will be much cloudier.
That's an inside beer joke. Now the
on a serious note, a different yeast, we know different yeast and so what moves us ahead is that research is being done with hops because people are using a lot more hops. So these biotransformations that happen when yeast interacts with the compounds in hops, when we identify that and we say, oh, linalool geraniol, then you create more citronelle. But of course, I have the mosquito plant that's citronelle. And that gives you a little bit of a limey character. Also, pretty much, I've determined that you can overdo almost every botanical. Mm-hmm. So it was like from Ryan Tockstein at Scratch's advice was use like half of what you were thinking about using. Mike's use a quarter of what Stan was thinking about using.
Yeah, you could easily brew potpourri if you're not careful.
Yeah.
You mentioned yeast. There's also a chapter in Foraging for Yeast, and that is sort of one of the trends now is that breweries are looking locally for their own, you know, local strains of yeast and other bugs to give character, a unique character to their beers too.
Yeah, a lot of, I mean, this is a very simple level. First of all, I had to be able to understand it. Looking at getting to mostly single strains of cerveza, because people are going to make, although recently it does appear that there may, they found strains in North Carolina. Somebody else says they're in Michigan. I haven't seen that, but at a documented level, then, you know, how they got there isn't exactly clear. So are they indigenous to the United States? But we know that there's yeast everywhere. You obviously want to find the yeast that likes working with maltose. That's the first one you can grab a lot of times off fruit and things like that. It's really good with sugar, not so good with maltose. But getting to a single strain and making it your own is kind of a fun thing. And you can sort that out and see how that character is different. It's going to be undomesticated. So it's still going to have it's going to have 4-vinyl glycol, which when it interacts with the ferulic acid, it's going to create those clovey phenols at a higher level. But if you can keep that restrained, then it becomes a spice.
And it's probably going to change over a few generations when you capture it and domesticate it,
right,
so to speak.
Yeah, it changes more at the beginning. And then over time, I mean, those yeast turned into California ale yeast, Fuller's yeast, all of those. But those are domesticated over thousands of generations and hundreds of years, where the brewers are constantly making selection. So when the beer, when you get better flocculation, when you hold the temperature down, therefore you have less variation than those yeasts. So you're always selecting those yeasts and you're kind of discarding the others.
And there's a food safety component to that. You're essentially letting your wort or whatever you're collecting the bugs in, you're letting it spoil. So, you know, there's an element of care that you have to take to make sure that you're not poisoning yourself. And there's an element that if you're out foraging for ingredients in the countryside or in the woods or whatever for your beer, there's also an element of food safety there as well.
Yeah, the example, well, at least here in the Midwest, everybody's familiar with mushrooms and that you need to be careful with mushrooms. You need to be that careful with everything. Mm-hmm. An example, I mean, ginger's fine. And I won't name any names, but there was one brewer somebody at a brewery wanted to do a collaboration with another brewery who knew a little bit about foraging. And he suggested they should go look for wild ginger. Wild ginger will make people sick.
Mm.
So, you know, and it wasn't the first brewer who knew it, it was somebody else who worked at the brewery. So you really need to go check that. And you can do it. You'll eliminate a lot of things that you're not allowed to use, you know, because that there is when a brewery writes a recipe and certainly to get label approval. But what they're really supposed to do is if you're using ingredients that are not on the allowed list, which used to be a really small list, it's expanded recently, but still less than 100, you need to submit that for approval. And there's, you know, a combination of things something simple may not be on there, like rose roots. And that can be hard to get approved, as opposed to you just say, I'm going to use the rose plant, and they go, okay, and leave it at that. But you start with that list. Those are approved ingredients, and you know that they're safe and are, you know, you'll continue to have neighbors that can say they like your beer.
And you don't want to shrink your fan base. You know, Yule Gibbons used to say some parts are edible. You know, that can apply here. You know, you can eat one part of a plant, but not part of the other. And for example, I think you mentioned apricot pits.
Right.
You don't want to put in your beer, but the flesh of the apricot obviously is edible.
Yeah, well, that's basically that's true. The pits of most fruit can be an issue. That includes like the apple seeds. You know, it has the obviously how large you are, how old you are, things like that affect it. But the amygdalin in apricot is the perfect example. So what happens is you've got an enzyme in your stomach that converts that to cyanide. And mead makers particularly have understood this with things like cherries and choke cherries. But then you've got a new set of people coming in and you just say, I'm going to take that apricot, for instance, and just throw it in and actually, I guess maybe crack the pit, you know, just put everything in there, let my beer sit on it or something like that. And that's when you start to create the problems.
You mentioned mead. Honey is an ingredient that, you know, would give you some benefit from finding a local beekeeper. This past weekend, I went to Cane Hill, Arkansas, which is just down the street from Prairie Grove here, and they were harvesting sorghum cane and pressing it in the old-fashioned way. They even, you know, they had a tractor hooked up to a press where they pressed out the juice of the sorghum cane, and they also had a mule, you know, going around in a circle and running a press, and then they took the juice and they cooked it down right there and skimmed off the chlorophyll, which was I thought was interesting, and so, you know, now I've got 3 12-ounce bottles of sorghum molasses, you know, that I plan to use in maybe a beer and a mead as well. So, you know, if there are lots of opportunities, no matter where you are, to find local ingredients to play with and to brew stuff that maybe nobody else in the world can brew.
Right. Well, sorghum's a great example. As that was one of the first reasons I said we're not going to do indigenous beers of the world, because those African sorghum beers really suck. And, you know, they're using the whole plant. But to give it a taste, in Kentucky, sorghum's like, you know, that's the syrup that people use. They know that flavor of sorghum. In fact, there's a recipe in the book, which is an old ale with sorghum from West 6th in Kentucky. And that's another example. Kentucky, they're really, you know, you're using local ingredients. Excuse me. You put that on your six packs, and there's really state approved local ingredients. And they're saying, let's make this Kentucky. And that's, what do you say? It's not just an advertising thing. It's part of their ethos.
You talk about some historic beer styles, and Kentucky Common is one of those. Talk a bit about the history and the practice of brewing a Kentucky Common.
Well, that goes, and there's a bit of a mystery, because you see the word common starts occurring more often as the 19th century goes along, and that means a beer that was made quickly. That part's pretty obvious. And how is it different than an ale? Because it must be top fermenting, but it meant not quite as good a quality as a beer. But then you had this sort of shifting over into another word that obviously had different meanings, which was cream and cream ale. And Kentucky Common comes out of common or cream ale. Germans totally dominated brewing in Louisville. It was, I think, late in the 19th century, there were 17 breweries in town. 16 of them were owned by people of German heritage. But they obviously had a refrigeration problem there. And so that they had been making these beers called common. But they took that technology of understanding how six row worked with an adjunct, and that's what they put together and began making Kentucky Common. It's like in the 1880s, 1890s. But they also were better off using dark malts because of their water. So that's the beer that came out. It's not particularly different than any place else, except it was unique pretty much to Louisville. They made a little bit north of Louisville in Indiana, maybe a little bit in Lexington, but it was really Louisville Common. And for some reason, the homebrewers remained interested in this after the end of Prohibition. And they started to get it in their mind that it would have been a sour mash, because that's where sour mash originated. And there were a couple descriptions of the beer having a certain tang to it. So over time, when it was revived, having been totally gone for 50, 60 years, it came back as a beer with a sour mash. So you've had this effort of, both homebrewers and some interest with the commercial brewers to go back and find the history. And what's a little bit different there is we actually have logs from the end of the 19th century. So the experiment of Prohibition eliminated so much of our brewing history, mm-hmm. where we can't go back and look at those record books. But you have the record books there, and it's clear it was not a sour beer. So it's a pretty straightforward beer, unique to the region. But now you got people in Dublin looking at the BJCP style guidelines and making this Kentucky Common beer. and it's hard to figure out what makes it special to them.
Well, we make Irish stouts, so, you know.
Yes.
But I want to talk about, I want to end up by talking about something closer to home, or at least my home. And that's, you went over to Krebs, Oklahoma.
Yes.
To talk to the Chalk Beer guys. And to talk about, Chalk Beer. And Michael Lawley, who's been on this program,
right.
sort of revived that style commercially. But that may be a beer that, the original version is not something that I want to brew. But but it is an indigenous beer. It is a beer influenced by local factors. But talk about Chalk Beer.
Well, again, this is a beer with a definite amount of mystery to it, because there are stories that it's the Indians teaching Italian immigrants how to make beer. Now, right there, you got to have some kind of disconnect, because there is no history of Indians using barley malt to make beer. They did use corn. About the same time Chalk originates, you know, you still have Geronimo interested in Tiswin, which is a corn beer. And we've got lots of nice oral histories of how that corn was malted. But then they grind it, and you're going, so where's the enzyme reaction going on? What happened here during the mashing process? And what about yeast? Later on, they probably had yeast, but you have that. But there's no indication there's a relationship between those Indians in Oklahoma who were talking to the miners and the Plains Indians before. So, you know, there's a good chance that this actually originates with very rudimentary with immigrants who came in to the Indian nation. And they made this beer, which every description of it, it is, there's malt involved. There's barley involved, malted barley. It may be ground, but it wasn't always ground. So conversion's a little bit iffy there. So in order to bring up the gravity, they just added a boatload of sugar. And then they learned for flavoring, which is probably what you're referring to, is they would do things like throw tobacco in there and various herbs that the Indians had used to kill fish. But that gave a little bit of, you know, it probably led to people occasionally hallucinating. And so they go, this is pretty good. So that exists at the beginning of the 20th century. And then an Italian miner gets hurt mining and starts Pete's Place, an Italian restaurant, and he's making the beer there in the 20s through Prohibition. An important thing to remember is throughout its history in Northeast, in the Indian Nation, they had Prohibition. It was, you know, there. It wasn't like other places. Somebody might, there be some guy up in St. Louis who knew how to make beer, and they would bring the beer down, and people would say, ooh, this is what it's supposed to taste like. Well, you couldn't do that in Oklahoma. So when they gave them this sugar water, fermented sugar water, they go, oh, that's what beer is supposed to taste like. And so there was no competition. So at Pete's Place, that was the place you could get beer. And it continued to be served for more than 50 years, even while much of the time. And then in 1933, Oklahoma did not repeal Prohibition. So there was just no competition, and there would be this, and people would hold, you know, the government people would hold meetings at Pete's Place and drink the beer made in the basement. And so it continued at that basis. So when Pete's Place, which is now Krebs Brewing, which also now owns Prairie Artisan Ales, wanted to open a brewery, they said, we want to create one of the things we want to do is serve chalk beer, which they do to this day. And people make it at home to this day in much the same it's just a fact of life, and I don't mean to be picking on them, but they're making beer like people who never read a homebrew book. So, and that's where, and Michael grew up in this setting, and he's going, and he's hired to be the brewer there. And this is a guy who ends up, he's won medals at GABF. And he's I'm not making a beer that tastes like that. So that's where he came up with the basic chalk beer recipe, which is, and using some wheat, which is a local ingredient. But otherwise, and it sells okay for him. People go there and will take home a six pack when they go to Pete's, which is a great Italian dining experience.
Now you said that they own Prairie Artisan Ales. Now, are you sure about that, or do they just contract brew for Chase? Mm.
They were contract brewing for Chase, so they were, that's one of the reasons they could buy that 50 barrel brew house, because they had a good firm contract with him. So it's a chunk of the beer, but they have bought that brand now.
Really,
within the last 3-4 months, I think.
Wow.
Chase has his own, what's he doing, a Solera?
He's got a little brewery up in Tulsa where we talked to him, or I talked to him. We.
So, that's where they started. And then they did the contract brewing down at Krebs. But they have, and so Michael was, and like, he said it's a great system, because Chase would just send him down a list of, this is what I want to make, and this ingredient, this amount, and stuff like that, and not really thinking about the price. And Michael said, I look at those sort of things and then go back, well, it's going to cost you this much, and then Chase would price the beer after that. So he started with flavor and what I want to have in it without really worrying about price, which is pretty cool. But like I said, I think he's doing, it has a different, I think he'd already created this company with a different name. I don't remember. And I think they may be all Solera beers.
Well, I know that he was doing some stuff, including he had started a quote unquote spontaneous fermentation beer, and I haven't checked back to see how that was going. But you've brought some news to me, Stan, here in my almost in my backyard. I don't know what's going on. I need to read more. Speaking of reading more, there's tons more. We've barely scratched the surface of this book. And it's a wonderful read, and all the listeners should go out and is it available now, or is it still okay?
I think Amazon will say ships October 7th, but you can order through the Brewers Association or through Amazon. And people have bought it through Amazon and have received it. If you're wed to using the Kindle edition, then that releases October 7th, I think it is. This book, I think, works fine from the Kindle edition. I don't think For the Love of Hops does as well, and certainly some of the other books. There are things that you like to have, and some people just like to have, they want to have the book and be able to flip it open and stuff like that. But this one works pretty well as a Kindle edition. Of course, what I really like is the people who tell me they like to have the book and then the Kindle when, on Saturday when they're in their garage brewing, because it's easier just to have right there in front of them. So buying both versions is perfectly okay with me.
Said the author.
Yes.
Well, it was great talking to you again, Stan, as usual. And we look forward to the next one.
Well, thanks for inviting me. Maybe in the interim, we can just talk about all four of them together before you send me out to do more research.
Thanks, Dan.
Okay, my pleasure.
Well, thanks again to Stan. Always great to talk to him. Brewing Local is battling it out with Chris Colby's Homebrew Recipe Bible for the top of the new releases in beer on Amazon. I know this because Chris post something every day on Facebook about about how his beer is doing. He's a little obsessive checking that list, but why wouldn't you be? Go ahead and get them both. Remember to send your emails if you want Steve and me to get together to do an email reading show. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com, or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. Please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our support link where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. Get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo. You can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store as well. You can find our logbooks. You can track and log up to 50 batches of beer. Check all that out at basicbrewingshop.com. And thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Lightning McQueen Muscle Toddler Costume. Halloween's coming up. And Lego Technique 42042 Crawler Crane. Legos are getting fancy. Looks pretty cool. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.